Live from KCUR News, this is Casey Currents on Central Standard, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. How many holiday cards are you getting this year? How many are you sending? For most people, the answer is fewer than last year. And here in Kansas City, we might feel the impact of that change a little differently than other places. That's because the biggest player in the greeting card industry is based here, Hallmark, of course. Today on Casey Currents, we take a look at Hallmark's bid to reinvent itself for the digital age. Plus, hear the story of a Casey boxer who gave up his career to fight the mob. He was known as the Chocolate Ice Cube.
You know, he didn't say much. He was really a calm guy, but you put a pair of gloves on him, and he would just dominate.
And we catch up with a homeless man who returned an engagement ring earlier this year. It's Casey Currents. Listen up just after this news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Welcome to Casey Currents. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. When you live in Kansas City, the name Hallmark means a lot of things. It's not just that lovely, sentimental moment or the slogan, when you care enough to send the very best. The century-old company is one of Kansas City's staunchest corporate citizens. And for generations, working there has been a dream job for artists and writers throughout the region. But people just aren't sending cards the way they used to. On today's show, we look at how Hallmark is trying to reinvent itself and the effect that that company's layoffs and restructuring has on Kansas City's life and culture. To kick off the show, we hear a little bit about what longtime employees call the old Hallmark. Hallmarkers past and present get together each year around the holiday season, not for an exchange of greeting cards, but of cookies. Here's an audio postcard of this year's gathering, produced by KCUR's Julie Deniche.
My name is Donna Moore. I started at Hallmark in 1962, and the cookie exchange started in 1965 or 1966. And we decided it would be fun to have a cookie exchange every single year and keep ourselves all in tune with each other. So it's been going on for 40-some years.
My name is Kathy Killip. I came to Hallmark in 1967, and I worked full-time until 1974. Christmas is always important at Hallmark because in the Christmas season, I think they're working on summer things, but you're experiencing Christmas in your homes, and then in the opposite season, you're experiencing Christmas at Hallmark because that's when the designing is done for Hallmark. So it's sort of like Christmas all year long.
My name is Jane Rudish. I am not a Hallmark artist, but I was married to a Hallmark artist, Rich Rudish. When people started with Hallmark in the 60s, they had new artist groups, and those groups really had camaraderie. And they would do things together, and when my husband was in charge of it, they would have social events to bring all these people together who were coming from different states. I mean, they came from all the art schools all over the United States, and this was a way for them to bond, and they did.
My name is Mary Ann Smith Getchell, and I came to Hallmark right out of school from Boston, got hired when I was 20, arrived here on the doorstep at 21. When I first started, we could not wear anything but dresses, and you're painting all the time. I mean, you had to wear a smock. So that's very different when you think of women in the 70s versus 2013. Took a lot of movement forward.
I don't remember ever that any male artists were ever invited. It was sort of a girls' thing, and it was so amazing to get together with all of our friends at Hallmark, because you came away from the cookie exchange being invigorated and refreshed and renewed, because everyone shared such a creativity for life that it was amazing.
My name is Kathy Barnard. I'm a glass artist here in Kansas City. I worked at Hallmark from 1977 to 1980. I opened my studio, my gallery, to have the cookie exchange here. This is probably the second year we've had it here. I love to share what I'm doing with the women here. It's always a wonderful network of people.
To be able to bond with multiple people who have reached a level of giving their creativity and sharing it with everybody, it's like food that replenishes you.
Well, I think that sharing of food is obviously the thing that really brings women together. And these women, dating back from before 1970 when I started, we want to keep together. We want to keep the friendships going that were so strong when we were at Hallmark. We'll be friends forever. I'm sure of it.
Those were the voices of old-time Hallmarkers at a cookie exchange that's been going on since the 1960s. You can find recipes for the cookies and a video from the event on our website, kcr.org. You can just hear the camaraderie between artists and writers who have come from around the country to work for Hallmark in Kansas City. The company, its employees, and former employees have had a big impact on our community's art, business, and philanthropic communities. But as Hallmark adapts its business to the digital age, what changes for Kansas City? Do you look for the little crown when you buy cards? Or do you even give cards out at all anymore? Call us with your thoughts at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And here to talk about the future of Hallmark and its role in Kansas City is Steve Mays, professor and chair of illustration at Kansas City Art Institute. Teaches many students over the years who have gone to work for Hallmark or who may have strived to work there. Welcome to KC Currents, Steve.
Thank you.
Also, Carl Franzen, news editor at TheVerge.com, just came to town to write a story called Sorry for Your Loss. Hallmark struggles to update its card empire. Carl's joining us via ISDN from New York City. Hi, Carl.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I don't know if I hear Carl yet, but he will join us in a minute, I believe. Steve, I wonder, what, from your perspective, teaching at the Art Institute, what do you see as students' connection with Hallmark, and how do they connect it with Kansas City?
Well, I think the students at KCAI in the past, Hallmark would come and view a lot of the different portfolios in the illustration department. I think Hallmark now has expanded their opportunity when they come to look at portfolios. And by that, what I mean is they look at the entire school rather than just illustration. So I think they're looking for other similar specific kinds of skills and maybe some new ones as well.
Interesting. So they used to really focus on the illustration department.
That's
and
right.
What did you see as your role? Like how many students over the years, let's say 20 years ago when you started there, how many students would go to work at Hallmark?
Oh, probably over those 20 years, I would think maybe 40 or so, maybe. There was more back in the 90s, and there are now, of course, but in the 90s, the internship at Hallmark was a coveted internship, and everybody was after it. And I think the program, to a certain extent, leaned its offerings in that direction. But over the years, quite a number.
Was there any change over the years from how Hallmark hired nationally versus regionally or locally here in Kansas City?
I don't know about that. I'm not sure. I do know that some of the other ACAD schools that they visit, and ACAD's an acronym for Association of Schools of Art and Design, are much larger than ours here at KCAI. So for their bang for the buck, if they were looking for talent, some of the other programs at other ACAD schools are a lot larger. So they may be still recruiting at those schools in a heavier way.
What about the University of Kansas? I understand they also – you have taught there in the past?
I have not.
Oh, you have not. Okay.
Not at the – I do have connections there with some of the faculty. And, of course, I'm an alum from there. So once in a while, I go back and return. I do know they have an amazing program there called Hallmark something.
The symposium.
The
it's
symposium.
A lecture
series
it. Mm-hmm. That students participate or have to take, I think.
Yeah, I think so. The Hallmark funds the bringing in of a lot of really keynote illustrators and artists. Yeah.
Well, that point that you made about how Hallmark is looking elsewhere is really interesting, not just in the illustration department. Now, I think it gets to what we'll be talking about now with Carl Franzen. I think he's with us now, the news editor at TheVerge.com, who came to Kansas City to write a story about some of the struggles and changes at Hallmark. Carl, welcome to KC Currents.
Thanks, Sylvia. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Great. What did you learn about Hallmark's significance in Kansas City when you came here to report your story? It seems like you talked to some people who are sort of outside of the industry.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we spent a lot of time both at Hallmark headquarters interviewing a lot of the artists and card designers there, as well as the executives. But we were in Kansas City for as part of a road trip series that we were doing, traveling to a bunch of different cities around the country. And so we wanted to explore the city and how the Hallmark really fit in with the local culture and, you know, just what people in the city thought of it. And so we did just spend some time traveling around, going to yard sales, just going to different parts of the community, restaurants, bars, talking to people and interviewing them about their opinion and affinity for Hallmark. And as it turns out, you know, of course, Hallmark is still to many people the first brand they think of when it comes to greeting cards and holidays and special occasions. But that being said, a lot of the people that we did speak to either had kids or were familiar with, you know, younger people in their families who, you know, preferred to, you know, maybe send emails or e-cards or, you know, of course, a lot of people use Facebook now to really even send, you know, happy birthday messages or those kinds of, you know, special greetings that would normally be Hallmark's forte.
And did you feel like the Kansas Cityans you talked to, though, felt a special connection to the company because it's based here?
Definitely. I think that, you know, pretty much everybody that's been in the town for, you know, been in Kansas City for any significant period of time, a year or more, recognizes the large cultural influence and presence that Hallmark has in the city. I mean, it's one of the largest employers, I believe the third largest, according to our research. And, you know, it's the members of Hallmark's employee family are of course, you know, members of the community in Kansas City as well. And that's the largest, you know, it's Hallmark's headquarters. So that's where all the artists are based.
Steve Mays, I wonder if you, from your experience teaching at the Art Institute and teaching students who have gone on to work at Hallmark, how much does the KC arts community owe to Hallmark? And what's the creative culture like there?
Well, Hallmark is an amazing resource of creative talent. They're amazing artists all in one building, and so to speak. And I use it a lot as a resource for teaching staff and I have a few that I use as adjuncts. But more importantly, I see them at every first Friday. I see all of them out in the community, not just visiting galleries, but showing.
All of them being employees or former employees of Hallmark?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And they're out there, and it's quite a strong presence.
And their creative work extends beyond just their work at Hallmark.
That's true, very much so.
Now, Carl, we're talking about this right now because, of course, it's the holiday season and people are exchanging cards or not right now. But how serious is the decline in the purchase of greeting cards?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's one that, you know, we tried to answer. It's difficult to quantify in Hallmark's case in particular because they are still a privately held company, which is, you know, actually quite interesting. I mean, they've been around for over 100 years now, and it's still privately held, and the whole family still controls the company. But what we found is that talking to research analysts, people who study, you know, this industry, that there's been a decline of about, I believe, 5.4%, according to one survey conducted by IBIS, a market analysis firm. 5.4% decline in revenue for the whole industry over the past 5 years. So it doesn't sound like a lot, but it's certainly enough to have an impact. And that decline is projected to continue through the next 5 years at the very least. So, you know, Hallmark has been public about some of the layoffs that they've had to make in the past 10 and 20 years, beginning around the late 90s. And so, you know, it's certainly an impact that's being felt on them and on the industry as a whole.
And just in the past few months, there was an announcement that there was another round of layoffs and buyouts, partly because they're deciding not to go to continue with the party cups and plates part of their business and changing the process of card manufacturing and probably
right.
to become more efficient. But their sales have slipped. You mentioned that they are a private company, so they don't have to report sales, but they do report some.
That's right. They tend to report, aggregate numbers as far as, you know, total revenue they made and those sorts of things. So from what we're able to glean from them, from what we're able to gather from what they've reported, you know, the company doesn't seem like it's in danger of going away anytime soon. But the question is, I think, that we tried to explore and, you know, I think came close to answering is, you know, what is the role of Hallmark going forward? How big of a part of people's lives is it going to be around special occasions? And, you know, how big are greeting cards going to be in people's lives going forward? And, you know, unfortunately, what we found from the younger generation and people that we talked to is just they don't think of greeting cards for all the occasions that they used to in the past. It's much more of a selective process when they go out and buy a greeting card.
And we had a caller who didn't want to come on the air, but Shelley shared that she always buys Hallmark cards. She really appreciates their environmental policy. She noticed that they have a number of cards manufactured in China, and if that's a growing trend. I know when I actually spoke to somebody at Ibis World who said that it is a growing trend for people to be concerned about cards being manufactured in the U.S. I don't know if that's something that you've looked at all, Carl.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely we see this across industries. You know, we tend to write about technology companies. And so even for things like the Apple iPhone, some of these new high tech tools that people are using to stay in touch, you know, people are concerned about, you know, where they're being manufactured. And Apple moved some of its production over here for their new Mac Pro computer recently, and other companies, Google, which owns Motorola, is manufacturing one of its new flagship phones, the Moto X, in the U.S. So we see this across, you know, various industries. There's been a sort of a renewed sense of interest in the Made in the USA label, and you see that with Hallmark, too.
You're listening to Casey Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're talking about Hallmark's changing business strategies with Carl Franson of TheVerge.com and the effects on Kansas City with Steve Mays of the Kansas City Art Institute. Are you a present or former Hallmarker? How has the company changed over the years, and how has the impact on Kansas City changed? Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can go to KCUR's Facebook page. What about e-cards, Carl? I know a lot of people are either sending cards digitally or also creating cards digitally, maybe using their own images. That personalization is a big trend. How has Hallmark kind of gotten in on that?
Certainly. There's actually a wide variety of options and offerings that Hallmark has now in both of those categories, both the customized or personalized cards and in terms of just e-cards in general that, you know, offer some customization, perhaps not, you know, uploading images. There are, of course, products that Hallmark offers that do enable that. But there's, of course, many other cards that are pre-created. And from what we spoke from the employees that we spoke with at the Hallmark headquarters in Crown Center, you know, it really depends on what you're looking for. I think, you know, many of the younger generation prefer customization, but many people still look to greeting cards to say what they can't say. Mm-hmm. That was a common refrain that we heard from Hallmark employees, is that they are able to communicate some of the feelings and emotions that people have for one another and for special occasions that those people might not be able to say themselves. So it might be going a little bit too far to say that Hallmark wants to put words in people's mouths, but it at least wants to give them the tools to be able to, you know, say something meaningful and thoughtful that they that customers couldn't, you know, come up with on their own or don't have the time to.
Now, you wrote that Hallmark was a little late to the e-card game.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, you know, in the 90s, they did launch a website that had e-cards, and it just wasn't as large an offering as some of the other startups at the time that have now since either been acquired or just gone out of business. So in that sense, you know, Hallmark's strategy was not necessarily a poor choice for the time. I mean, they clearly saw that they had, you know, a fairly healthy paper card business still, and it just didn't make sense for them, I don't think, to really, you know, pour a bunch of resources into moving things over to the digital side. But nowadays, you know, I think that especially as we talk about the younger generation having access to smartphones, tablets, it's just I think pretty clear to everybody that the future of media consumption is going to occur primarily, if not, you know, in a majority sense, through mobile digital devices. So, we could knock them for failing to anticipate that, but it was something that I think has caught a lot of industries by surprise, including, of course, our own, the news and journalism and media industry. So they're playing catch up like the rest of us. It's just taken them a little bit more time, I think, to really figure out what they want to pursue.
Well, this is obviously a much broader question than just Hallmark. But Steve Mays, I wonder what that means for your students and your teaching in the illustration department at the Art Institute, this idea that media is moving not just words, but images too, digitally.
Yeah, we over the years, as Carl mentioned, sometimes it takes companies or it takes institutions a little while to kind of get on the bandwagon with what's going on currently digitally. And I remember huge arguments about whether the computer was a tool or not in the 90s. And that's
over now.
that's far over, yeah, now. What it means for us is that I think as Hallmark used to come and still does, but in a more broad way of viewing student portfolios, I think what it means to us is that we have made an effort to seek out new internship sites for these students. And what it means is finding smaller companies, startup companies, not relying so much on the large corporation. I remember in the 90s we had the coveted internships were Disney out of Florida, Hallmark here in town, the Kansas City Star locally. All those internships went away when we the school decided to close the illustration program in 2005. They wanted me to bring the program back in the fall of 2010, so we did. And what it means for us now is that we are, because we have an internship requirement for all of our students, and in our program we have over 100, we have to go out and find new sites. And we're finding that the smaller startup, smaller company.
You mean in the advertising industry also?
All over, everywhere.
That's grown in Kansas City, has it?
Mm-hmm. Advertising, editorial, animation, lots of things. But what we found is that the students with the smaller company get to work with the CEO, not for the CEO. And it's an extension of their experience, the internship, to see the company from the inside out rather than just play a peripheral role.
We have a call here from Jim from Kansas City. Hi, Jim.
Sir. Yes.
What's your comment for our guest today?
Well, more of an observation. I have been in the printing and graphic arts industry for over 40 years, and my observation is that, you know, the support industries like printing and graphic arts and craftsmen that have helped produce these cards, the industry itself has been decimated. You know, printers that had committed large amounts of press time and production time to produce those cards are, a lot of them are just history in this community. And to even go further, you know, the paper manufacturers that help support that have been hurt too. So it's a domino effect, and Hallmark itself loses employees, and then the support industry loses employees, and it's changing of the tide. You know, I call on printers throughout the Midwest, from Texas to Kansas City, and they're all being impacted by this digital age, and people are trying to figure out what the new normal is just to stay alive.
Is there any way to move forward? I mean, is there any with the move away from paper and towards digital?
You know, I wish I knew the answer to that. You know, the press runs get smaller. You talked about, or your guests talked about, customized greeting cards. I mean, those are niches that people are trying to get into in every facet of printing, whether it be, you know, direct mail pieces. I know Hallmark even tried to do customized paper plates to put, you know, if Sally's birthday was on Saturday, they tried to have a paper plate with Sally's picture on it. It's, I mean, everybody's grasping for what's going to keep things going. And, you know, I had a lawyer tell me one time, Jim, you're selling candles. Maybe you just need to get out of the industry. So that's my observation, and I'm in my late 50s. So it's been hard for lots of people, not just Hallmark cards themselves.
Well, thank you, Jim. That's a really good addition to our conversation. And I wonder, Carl of Franson, you know, over the past decade, hundreds of Hallmark Gold Crown stores have also closed. HMK
yes.
is the new experience store on the plaza, which is kind of a new concept and maybe a sign of the new direction that Hallmark wants to go, maybe to emphasize gifts more than cards. Did you pay a visit to the store while you were here?
Yeah, we actually visited a wide variety of Hallmark stores while we were there. And, you know, it is interesting to see them explore different options with that retail experience. Again, you know, the difficult thing is a retail outfit is still Hallmark talked a lot about the difference between an analog business and a digital business. And so a retail and their executives, including the people in charge of their digital division, were very clear that, you know, most of Hallmark's name recognition and the goodwill that the brand has built up still exists in what we could consider an analog space or a physical environment, whether that be going to a retail, a Gold Crown store or this new type of experience or just getting that paper card in the mail. It's all these tangible things that, you know, we're used to from just years and years, over 100 years in the case of Hallmark, of business. Now, the issue is going forward, lots of people are choosing to consume media, whether that be physical media or digital media, through mobile devices and through computers. So, you know, you look at something like Amazon or eBay, and lots of people are ordering stuff online. They just don't want to get up and go to the store. It's just more convenient, especially, you know, if you live far away from a store that you might choose to visit or a store that carries the products that you want. It's easier to order that online if that's, you know, available.
But I understand that at HMK on the plaza, which is right next to the Apple store and Lucky, which is kind of interesting, but they'll give you a cookie when you walk in, which you can't get from Amazon.com.
Well, not yet, at least. I mean, Amazon, I know, is already has some experiments going on where they're delivering groceries in San Francisco. They deliver wine in, I think, over a dozen states at this point. So, you know, they're coming for that too, unfortunately, for those who appreciate sort of the, you know, in-store or in-retail brick-and-mortar experience.
We have a call here from Eleanor here in Kansas City. Hi, Eleanor.
Hello, Sylvia. I just wanted to make one quick comment about Hallmark. It was not only just cards. Joyce Hall of the Hall family started, this is back in the 40s, when downtown Kansas City was thriving, a beautiful store with beautiful art subjects in there, crystal, silver, jewelry. And you could go in that store and it was like going into a museum. You didn't have to have deep pockets to enjoy it. He would invite you in to see the beautiful things. And this store then moved to the plaza, and they continued with his same type of beautiful in the department of silver and crystal and their jewelry. And that, in my sense, inspired many artists, and many artists visited the store. And that's another area of Hallmark that should be recognized, because I think the Hall's Plaza store was always considered the adopted child of Hallmark.
Interesting.
But it is absolutely the very inspirational to all artists in the city.
And, of course, that store is now going to consolidate with the store at Crown Center, which is going to be remodeled and expanded. And that's something that we can't even really get to today, but the changes at Crown Center and how the company's success or challenges will impact that. But thank you so much for that comment. I appreciate that. Just quickly, Carl, I just wonder, what about these gifts and objects that Hallmark's working on? Steve Mays mentioned that they're looking in other departments at the Art Institute for students, perhaps from sculpture or from other aspects of the school, to come up with ideas for other things besides cards.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we saw a lot of efforts going towards, other types of keepsakes and gifts, just experiments around that taking place at Hallmark. There's a new laboratory that they have in the Hallmark headquarters at Crown Center, where artists can go up and experiment with some high tech tools to help create these types of new toys or gifts. So there's 3D printers up there where you can prototype a plastic toy. There's laser cutters where you can. We saw people, interestingly enough, creating handcrafted looking cards. So maybe something that looked like a woodcut, let's say, And so it was really striking to us. I think myself and the video producers who went down with me to see these high tech tools being used to give the appearance that the card was handcrafted, that the card or the gift was made out of wood, but really it was plastic or something like that. So a lot of interest in experimentation in that area, people experimenting with balloons, educational toys, robotic voice activated plush dolls that sync with mobile apps. So a lot of experimentation going on.
Interesting. Well, unfortunately, we have to end our conversation here. Carl Franson is news editor for TheVerge.com. He recently wrote about Hallmark. You can find a link to his story on our website. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Steve Mays heads the illustration department at the Kansas City Art Institute. Thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome. Why don't you talk?
It's time now for Tell KCUR. Every week we're sending out a question over the airwaves, Facebook and Twitter, and compiling the answers. This week the subject was office holiday parties. There's always someone who gets a little overzealous with the dancing, like Elaine on that Seinfeld episode.
Who's dancing? Come on, who's dancing? You want me to get it started? I'll get it started.
And there's lots of other ways you can embarrass yourself. But you all shared some office party do's and don'ts. Here is a compilation from KCUR's social media producer, Allison Rollitz. She's a part of our new community engagement team. Hey, Allison.
Hi, Sylvia. Thanks for having me.
So what kind of response did you get?
Well, I have to say, we've been doing this for almost a month at KCUR, and we got some comedians this time, lots of funny responses, but a lot of them around alcohol and significant others and what to do and not to do with them at office parties.
That's the danger, what is not happening usually at the office. So what are some things people said you should do at an office party?
Got it. And we actually got a really good kind of social media tip from Werder on Twitter. I had never thought about this before. He said, before the event, disallow others from tagging you in photos on your social platforms. And I have to say, I think I'm going to start doing this from now on. On Google Plus, Sean Howard told us, limit your alcohol consumption and leave early. Leave very early. We actually had a lot of comments on when to leave and when not to leave, so that was pretty funny. And then also on Google Plus, Rob Scuddy actually gave a really practical tip if you're worried about how much you're going to drink. He said, if you think you might stray, take some coins with you and move one coin to an empty pocket for each drink you have. My limit is 3 coins.
And what are the don'ts? What do people advise people not to do?
Jenny Vergara on Twitter, she said, don't mistake your coworkers for your confidants and don't do any public displays of affection with anyone, including your spouse. And I have to wonder, what if there's mistletoe at the party, Sylvia? I'm not quite sure. Lisa Qualls on Twitter, she also said, don't be the last one to leave. And don't be afraid to talk to leadership. They're peeps just like you. And
that's interesting advice.
Yeah, definitely interesting advice. I think a lot of times people will avoid the executives at those parties, but they're humans too. And then another one from LinkedIn, actually. We've reached out to folks there. And Nicholas Glanzer said, don't get into any angry arguments about white elephant gift exchange rules. It makes everyone uncomfortable.
And some people did get a little outrageous. There's some we are not going to read here.
Yeah, there are actually some comments that I don't feel comfortable reading on the air. You can go online and find them. But CityGirl1613, she tweeted us, no twerking, and make sure at least one other person gets drunker than you.
And then, combative.
Definitely. And on Google Plus, Peter DeMarco, he laid out this scenario, which cracked me up. He said, don't try to make out with the boss's wife. Don't start a bar brawl. Don't pull a Motley Crue and trash the restaurant. Yes, I have seen all of these happen. No, I wasn't involved in any of them.
So follow these tips and don't be the one to show up red-faced on Monday morning. Allison Rollitz is the social media producer on our community engagement team. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks so much, Sylvia.
Coming up after the break, the story of an up-and-coming Casey Kayborn boxer and his bout with the mob. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Tommy Campbell was the greatest boxer you've never heard of. In the late 1940s and early 50s, the Kansas City, Kansas native became the world's number two ranked lightweight fighter. He won almost as many fights as Muhammad Ali. But his boxing career was cut short when he stood up against mob-controlled promoters and boxing matchmakers. Casey Currents' Susan Wilson recently caught up with author Phil Dixon, who tells a story in his upcoming book, Tommy Campbell, A Boxing Bout with the Mob. Dixon tells Susan that he actually grew up across the street from the mother of the man known as the Chocolate Ice Cube.
Tommy was a guy, he didn't get too high, didn't get too low. They used to say that he would come in the ring like a preacher. And, you know, he didn't say much. He was really a calm guy, but you put a pair of gloves on him. And, you know, he would just, you know, he would just dominate. And so they said, man, this guy is like really cool. And of course, you know, coming from the period they were in, you know, they used a lot of kind of racial things that they would connect the name. So, you know, like Joe Louis was the Brown Bomber or something like that. So anyway, they gave him the Chocolate Ice Cube. And the name stuck. It was a writer for the L.A. Times who tagged him as the Chocolate Ice Cube.
So now we're talking about the late 40s, early 50s. What was the climate like at that point for African-American boxers?
It was one of the greatest period for African-American boxers. Most of the champions at that time, unfortunately, were controlled by the mob. And so who fought who and who was to take a dive to another fighter so they could build up another fighter, that type of thing, to fight for the title. A lot of this was controlled by mobsters, and there was this great anticipation to find out how it worked so that they could end it. But it affected the careers of many outstanding African-American fighters.
When you talk about the role of the mob at that time, what was their role, though? How would you describe some of their activities at that time?
Well, one of the things was they would become managers of the fighters. So you had like Blakey Palmero, who was he was the manager of Ike Williams, for instance. Ike Williams was a world champion, and everyone knew he had mob connections. He was the mob, and everyone knew that. But he was able to still manage a fighter, and there are other cases where people who were not, like say, known to be mobsters, they were connected to mobsters. So if you wanted to have a title fight, if a particular mobster didn't have a piece of you, you wouldn't get that fight.
Uh-huh.
And then they would arrange fights. Some of the matchmakers worked for the mob. And so they would arrange certain fights. They were breaking all the rules of boxing and a fair play and getting away with it.
And the throwing of the fights was mainly to win money because of betting on fights, or changing the position of other fighters, or exactly what motivated that?
Yes, you're correct. The gambling that was connected, if there were two fighters and they were in an important fight and you knew the outcome of the fight, of course you knew how to gamble on the fight so you wouldn't lose. In other words, it was a sure thing, sure bet. And so many of the mobsters made money off of the fights. They would fix those fights, of course.
How about Tommy Campbell? How did his run-in with the mob begin?
Well, Tommy actually turned pro out of Rock Island, Illinois in 1946. The guy who was his manager at that time was a numbers operator, and he was Tommy's original manager. He took Tommy out to California about 1947, and he sold his contract to a guy by the name of Babe McCoy. And Babe McCoy was a matchmaker who was not supposed to have any of his contract. And so Babe actually went out and hired two more people to look like they were the management, to be his trainer. So it was all set up that way. And then McCoy, since he was a matchmaker, he would determine which fights that Campbell fought in. And so that's the way that Tommy got connected to Babe McCoy. And he signed a 3-year contract with Babe McCoy because, see, one thing about it, if these people did not have a piece of you, you couldn't fight, no matter how good you were. So
he probably knew there was some kind of mob connection, but since he wanted to fight, he kind of went along with it at first.
Yeah, and I think when he first got there, he thought maybe it was because McCoy was so well known that he thought maybe he was just connecting with a matchmaker. He didn't know how deep this really ran.
What was the situation that happened that Tommy started balking at what the mob wanted him to do in terms of fighting?
Tommy fought a guy by the name of Luther Rollins out of Chicago, Luther Rollins, and he lost that fight. So he went to Babe McCoy. I think this might have been Tommy's like third or fourth loss or something like that. He went to Babe McCoy, and Babe McCoy tried to hold back and not give him his entire purse. So to Tommy, who was normally a mild-mannered guy, got in an argument with Babe McCoy. And Babe McCoy said, "Yeah, I'm going to give you your money." He said, "But you're through." He said, "You're not going to ever fight again." And this had been Tommy's profession at this point. He's good. He's good. He's rated high. And he's basically looking at, "I'll never fight again. This guy holds his contract. He's a matchmaker, and he won't sit anything for him." So Tommy went out and tried to find a job. Anyway, a little time passed, and Babe comes back to him and says, "Listen, I'll give you a fight against Art Aragon, who was at that time one of the big draws. He was the original golden boy of California." And he said, "But you're going to have to take a dive." And so Tommy agrees to take a dive against Art Aragon. And at a later point, he tried to get out of it. Of course, they had all these gambling things set up. And so anyway, his manager at that time, George Moore, said, "Hey, you can't back out. You can't back out." And that time, he began to fear for his life. And so he did go ahead and go through with that match. And he took a basically he got knocked out for the first time in his career ever. And he was probably in like his 30th fight. He got knocked out. Basically, it was all set up. And from that point, there was an investigation because it looked like it was a thrown fight. And Tommy, you know, he came up with an excuse that, Aragon hit him in the eye and he couldn't see. And that's why, you know, he went down. But he also said, "I'm not throwing any more fights." But he did not tell the mob who came after him to throw another fight.
So how did he end up being on a witness stand testifying against the mob?
In March of 1956, the California state governor had been trying to bring an investigation to find out how much organized crime had infiltrated professional boxing in California. They knew it was bad, but they couldn't get anyone to talk. And they went through a series of fighters, hoping someone would testify, maybe come forth with some information, and no one would. And then finally they ran into Tommy Campbell, and they wanted to know about the Art Aragon fight from 1950. And he said, "Hey, I'll be happy to testify." And he said at that point that he had no more fear of those people hurting him. And he was living in Phoenix at that time. He retired in 1951, and he was working at an airplane manufacturing plant. And he came to California on his own account and began to testify against the mob. And he not only did he talk about the Art Aragon fight, he talked about two other fights that they had tried to get him to take a dive in. He just began to name names. And at that time, other boxers saw him talking, and they had the same story. And the reason I think that he didn't get in more trouble is because they started coming to testify as well. And about 7 or 8 of them came and testified on the stand after they heard Tommy Campbell. Before then, they weren't going to testify. But they were after certain people. They were after Babe McCoy. So Babe McCoy lost his license forever. He couldn't come near a boxing ring for the rest of his life.
So I guess there was some justice in all of this after all. Now, what's known once he left boxing about the rest of his life? What happened then?
After he testified in 1956, he goes back, and later he moves to Seattle, Washington, and he worked for Boeing. He becomes an avid bowler and thought about turning professional. He was that good. In 1969, he went out to the bowling alley, and he's bowling and has a heart attack and dies at the bowling alley.
And he dies relatively young, right?
Yeah, I think he was 48. I don't think he had his 49th. It was early in the year, so yeah, he was still 49 years old, somewhere in there.
Now, did you get the sense as you researched Tommy that he was bitter or angry about his boxing career kind of being cut short or him not getting the kind of recognition that he truly deserved?
Well, you know, in reading about him, I never saw where he actually said that, but he did say that there were certain fighters who said, like, for instance, Ike Williams sparred with him and said, hey, you'll never get me in the ring and take my title. And he would tell people, you know, some of the things the fighters would say. But I never got that sense. It's probably for me to see how splendid an athlete this guy was, how well-liked he was. And just to know that he never got the opportunity to really achieve at the level that he could have achieved at, I'm probably a little more angry than anybody else. But I think he understood that at that time, when if you got in boxing, it was a very seedy profession, and you had very little control of your career. And I think he understood that, and you just kind of go as far as you can.
Phil Dixon is the author of the upcoming book, Tommy Campbell, A Boxing Bout with the Mobsters. Thanks for joining us here on KC Currents.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
At the end of each year, lots of people look back and take stock. But no one has a 2013 story to tell quite like Billy Ray Harris. He went from panhandling on the Country Club Plaza to being a media sensation after returning a lost engagement ring. People from around the world were inspired by his story and donated enough money to change his life. Now that things have calmed down a bit, Billy Ray Harris looks back on the year with gratitude and a little bafflement. Alex Smith has the story.
In the final weeks of the year, the plaza gets packed with shoppers at night. You can also find the Salvation Army, a few Hare Krishnas, and of course, panhandlers.
You know, Christmas is coming, and people get a lot more generous. And if you have any chance of making some real money, this is about the time you do it.
For years, Billy Ray Harris made money by asking for change on the plaza. He kept a regular schedule, noon to 4, then about 7 to 10. He was homeless and says panhandling gave him some stability and even peace of mind.
At the very worst, I'm going to eat today and I'm going to be able to buy whatever I want to eat, you know, if that was it. And that was fine with me.
Harris originally came from Wichita Falls, Texas. He'd worked in an oil field, did construction, and worked in a recording studio before ending up homeless in Kansas City. But things changed in a big way for Harris not long after the holidays. In February, a Kansas City woman accidentally dropped her diamond ring in Harris's cup. When she came back looking for it, Harris returned the ring. He thought that was the end of it, until local media found out.
2 days later, I had like three stations lined up on the sidewalk waiting their turn to interview me. I was like, oh, my God.
Billy Ray Harris got that change and then some last Friday.
Billy Ray Harris sits on the sidewalk in Kansas City, Missouri.
Later, when she pulled some cash out of the purse to give to the homeless man, she accidentally scooped up the ring.
Billy Ray Harris.
Soon, Harris's story appeared on national and even international news.
People were telling me that I was on this and I was on that, and I was like, what? You know, I mean, like, Yahoo, Google, or whatever. And I had not a clue.
USA Today, NPR, the BBC.
And we're happy to be joined this morning by Sarah Darling, her husband Bill Krejci, and Billy Ray Harris. Nice to see you.
Harris was even flown to New York City to appear on the Today Show. He was a good sport, playing his part to give reporters their story, but he admits it got a little old.
I wasn't too excited about answering all these questions.
The Ring's owner, Sarah Darling, and her husband Bill started a crowdsourcing project to raise money for Harris. The original goal was $1,000, but then donations started coming in. One donor called him the perfect cosmic citizen. As someone who'd faced a lot of bad luck, Harris said he wasn't prepared for the response.
And after it really did start taking off, I mean, I was almost scared to look at it then. You know, because I didn't want to get my hopes up that high.
The grand total for the fundraiser, over $190,000.
Actually, thank the good Lord for that blessing.
Then the possibilities of the money started stirring his imagination.
My first and foremost number one deal was to go out and get a new Camaro.
But after he found out the cost of a new Camaro and insurance, Harris decided on a more modest option.
It's a 98 Volkswagen. Which I kind of had pimped out a little bit.
Harris's Beetle is a ragtop with a custom spoiler and black and silver paint job.
It's just an eye catcher, you know.
This year brought Harris another unexpected surprise. He'd been out of contact with his family in Texas for over 16 years, but during the media frenzy, they reached out to reconnect.
I was kind of overwhelmed, you know. I mean, I didn't think it was going to happen in my lifetime. Being 50-something years old and been out of touch that long, you just figure you ain't going to get in touch.
It's not just family getting in touch. After the fundraiser and the news coverage, a lot of old acquaintances looked him up, now asking for his help.
More money, more problems means that you got everybody else's problems on your shoulder all of a sudden.
Today, Harris is doing some work as a sound engineer, and he's kept in touch with his family. But he says he sometimes misses the freedom and simplicity of his old life.
I actually have been enjoying myself a little bit more, you know, more or less, you know, other than all the confusion and stuff behind, you know, all of this. And trust me, it's been a lot of confusion. Chaos, basically. But, you know, not a bad thing, I would say. It's just that I got to juggle so much stuff now.
Harris says one of the hardest parts of this year has been getting out of the day-to-day frame of mind and learning to think in the long term.
I'm still in the right here, right now mode. You know, that's one thing I have never been able to get out of. You know, good luck, bad luck. You know, it's like right here, right now, I'm focused on that, and whatever happens, happens.
If you're on the plaza in the next week or so doing some shopping, you might see Billy Ray Harris, but he won't be one of the panhandlers.
I still drive through the plaza and, you know, basically see him actually stop and give money now, you know, believe it or not.
Harris still doesn't have a full-time place to stay, but says he's working on buying a house. I'm Alex Smith, Casey Currents.
That's it for Casey Currents today. Our live broadcast is now every Thursday morning. If you missed part of the show, want to hear it again, or get in touch, check out our page at kcur.org or tweet us at Casey Currents. Central Standard is back tomorrow. Author Phil Dixon brings you the story of another boxer, Jack Johnson, this time. Next on Up to Date, Casey saxophonist Bobby Watson, plus the weekend to-do list. Today's Casey Currents was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Alex Smith, Susan Wilson, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from Esther Honig and Ross Steinmetz. We say goodbye to our intern Esther this week. She's been a hardworking member of the Casey Currents team this fall, filing stories on everything from turkey farmers to cell phone use at music venues to tech startups. We'll miss her voice on the air and her enthusiasm at the station. Good luck, Esther. Looking forward to hearing you on the radio. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR.